Hello, 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 everyone. Welcome to Safe Space, the ABA podcast. My name is Michelle Zeman, and I am your host for this evening. Be sure to listen for those two code words so that way you can receive your free CEUs. Today, I am super excited to be introducing this guest. Her name is Amanda Lombardo, and she is from the Autism Professional Learning and Universal Supports Project. Welcome to the podcast, Amanda.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, you got it, of course. I'm super excited to hear about what you're doing for the state of Illinois and hearing about the project that you're working on. This is something that really everyone needs to hear about. So why don't we start out just by having you talk a little bit about the grant. Give us a quick overview.
Yeah. I first want to just preface with, I wish I could take credit for this incredible grant that was started, but Nikki Michalik is the one who actually wrote the grant proposal and got everything started with this incredible project, and I really have to thank her. But we are funded through the Illinois State Board of Education, and we are housed at Illinois State, and we have now had the expansion of some remote positions, so we can be kind of all over the state. And we assist the Illinois State Board of Education in addressing significant behaviors of students that are school aged. Specifically with autism spectrum disorder and related behavior and communication disorders, we use a comprehensive approach and use professional learning, technical assistance, coaching, and collaboration. We have worked really closely with some school teams in order to provide tier level support to them to address those specific needs that they might have in order for them to improve those services and outcomes for their learners. We've also promoted proactive supports so that they can reduce their numbers of instances of restraint and timeout. We also have built kind of our local capacity in Bloomington Normal and really tried to enhance the fidelity of implementation of evidence-based practices throughout the state of Illinois. And then we have also seen a very large increase in the percentage of students who qualify for services underneath that ASD eligibility, and really trying to get them educated in a general education classroom if possible, and if it meets that student's needs.
Wow, that is really, really awesome. You know, it's amazing to hear that, you know, you're working really closely on this grant, and even though you didn't create it, you're still a big part of it. You know, you still play a very pivotal role within this grant. So tell us a little bit about like what your role within this specific project is, so that way the listeners can get an idea of that.
Yeah. So I am the RBT program coordinator. My position was created at the end of last year, and I took my position in January. And really, my position was created to create a 40-hour RBT course that people can use that work in a school setting that really focuses on what it's like to be an RBT or support learners that are school-aged. So I am following all the BACB guidelines, all the things that they have that are requirements for that 40-hour course. And I am building it from scratch using resources, of course, that we've had and built since the grant has started. But I kind of have made it my own and made it really encompassing those trauma-informed and client-centered approaches.
I love that. I feel like that is just so important to really hone in on, especially that trauma-informed approach, that client-centered approach. And also working in schools, I mean, it is very different from, you know, working in a center, working in a client's home, you know, being able to apply that within a school setting, I feel is so significant.
Absolutely. And I've been seeing a ton of conversations on, you know, is there anything out there as far as courses for, you know, what it's specifically like for RBTs in a school setting? And there's really not a lot of options out there. So it was great to be able to kind of go into this position and really be able to build a solid foundation for people that work in schools.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm curious to know, you know, because you mentioned you basically are like honing in on this project. This is like your baby, essentially. So tell me, like, from your perspective, what inspired you to do this in the first place?
Yeah. So I was in a therapeutic day school setting for 7 years. I kind of went from para RBT to BCBA. And I really saw what this grant can do for schools. Firsthand, we had a partnership with the A+ grant. That's kind of our abbreviation for it. And they were able to connect us with resources and trainings to be able to bring back to our school staff and train them and better support them and provide that coaching that we weren't doing previously. I feel like we were very reactive in our approaches. We were using a lot of restraint and timeout. And by being connected with this grant and their resources that they had and the Ukiru training that they sent us to, they paid for us to go to, it really gave us those trauma-informed practices and a lot of those mandated topics that the Illinois State Board of Education now has as a requirement for all school personnel who implement restraint and timeout to have now. So it's been really great to kind of see it from the other side as well as be in this side. So it really inspired me to want to do something like this and really be able to support not only one school, but a lot of different schools across not only even our state, but, you know, hopefully the country, because our resources are made available for anyone who wants to take them or use them or print them off our website.
Absolutely. That is amazing. You know, and the fact that you have been able to see on both sides, I'm curious to know, what has the shift been like since the implementation of the grant?
Yeah, well, kind of the grant really came from some national attention that came from a ProPublica article. They partnered with the Chicago Tribune and they published a investigative story. It basically went through a decade of injuries and deaths that occurred due to the improper use of restraint and timeout. It drew so much attention and people were very shaken up about what this could mean for our entire state. So kind of being from that point in 2019, kind of where we are now, I feel like there's a lot of things that the grant does for ISBE as well as the state as far as providing a comprehensive 7-hour modules that cover the mandated topics for the state. So those are made available to everyone to take. You can contact us directly for your school entity to take all of those modules. And that counts towards, if you were ever, you know, if they ever open a action against you, you would have that as a, hey, I took these ISBE approved courses through our sister grant, and they were able to provide that training to all of my staff instead of kind of having to make it up on your own and maybe not hitting all of the points that the Illinois State Board of Education wants you to hit. Because they do have mandated topics that they need you to complete in order for you to utilize timeout and restraint.
That's interesting. You know, so I live in Florida, just to give you an idea. So I don't know anything about like the mandated topics. So can you explain what those would be and how they would be incorporated within the 7-hour training?
Yeah. So we have From this article that came out, ISBE decided to issue, well, there was a House bill made, and then ISBE made rules and regulations regarding the use of timeout. So they banned certain restraint techniques totally altogether. So prone restraint is not allowed in the state of Illinois, along with a lot of other states. They were trying to, and continue to, are trying to, supine restraint is being looked at a lot. So prone, for those that don't know, is when you're laying on your stomach, and then supine is where the individual would be laying on their back. So prone is no longer allowed. And then they had some things that they needed to ensure that everyone did. So one of those things being you need to have some kind of plan of how you're going to reduce restraint for your district or your school entity. And they did this for all the public schools. And just recently, they made it for all of the non-public facilities. Mm-hmm. Part of those topics include the trauma-informed practices, behavior management practices, and signs of distress, restorative practices, and crisis de-escalation. So all school personnel have to have the required 7 hours of training in order to ensure that they are able to use the restraint and timeout within their facility.
Okay. And is the training like a virtual training? Is there online, or is there in-person courses as well?
Yeah. So this is through our sister grant, which is the Center for Intensive Behavioral Support. And this is also same funding, same housed at Illinois State. But they really were made to create those online self-paced modules. So these are available through the website as well. You can have your whole district sign up for these courses. And they have been looked over by ISBE, made to be approved by ISBE, and they count towards all of those hours. So a lot of districts will have all of their school staff sign up at one time, and they'll give them, you know, from this date to this date to complete them on their own time, through work hours, whatever it is. And they can get all of that, and they have to do this within a year. So every year you have to do the 7 hours of training. You get a nice documentation that you also have to put in that staff's file, because that has to be documented somewhere too, in case they do ask you for all of your documentation. It has to be reported for every single one of your school personnel that implements restraint and timeout.
That's awesome. As far as, you know, number one, having to do this on a yearly basis, I think that, you know, these types of practices and these types of modules do need to be, you know, done on, you know, at least a yearly basis, at the very least. You know, that's really great to see that this is happening in your district, it's happening in the state. Now, tell me if, like, let's say, you know, brand new personnel signs on the middle of the year, but they don't have that 7 hour training. What does that mean for that person?
That means that they would have to get that training completed within that year time period. I know, like, my facility, we kind of did it as they fell into that rotation, and then we kind of covered all of the topics every single month. So it was just easier for we did make our own, but it was just easier for us to incorporate it every single month and just keep talking about it. Like, there are so many things that you can say about trauma-informed care. There are so many things that you can talk about with crisis de-escalation. So having that be a portion of our professional development that we were doing was super important. So I know a lot of schools will do that, or they'll just do it as like an onboarding process where once a new staff starts, they will contact us or have them go on our website, and they'll have them take those self-paced modules.
Absolutely. Oh, wow. That's really interesting, you know? And, so tell us a little bit about, like, what these, modules and what like you have to do now, you know, especially like these two types of restraints. One is banned completely. One is, you know, being looked at. So what are some of the strategies that, you know, the paraprofessionals and the staff members are basically doing to help decrease the restraint, the use of restraint and timeout?
Yeah, I think it was both, like, it really opened up everyone's eyes in the state to kind of think outside the box, and not saying that this stuff wasn't there or that we probably should have been doing it before, but it really made us take a look at what we were doing and how we were really being more reactive than proactive. We were, you know, responding to those behaviors instead of trying to prevent them from occurring. So I think individual schools did a lot of like soul searching, if you will, and like, what are we doing here? How can we change? But the state really came down and was like, you know, this is the best for the students, and this is going to keep, you know, those fatalities from occurring and injuries from occurring. So we need to ensure that we have all of these rules and regulations in place so that we can kind of move forward and really hone into those evidence-based practices, which finding out, like, there's not a whole lot of training that's being, you know, conducted with teacher training throughout their undergrad. They're really not taking a huge deep dive into all of those evidence-based practices for individuals with autism. So really our grant focuses on those evidence-based strategies so that we can bring those back to the schools, because honestly, those are those foundational things, you know, as far as like visual strategies, those things, communication systems, looking at those basic things within a school and trying to reduce their minutes, just incorporating those very easy and proactive strategies.
Wow. And, you know, it's interesting because you mentioned like the inadequate training. I can tell you from the state of Florida's perspective. So actually, funny enough, when it comes to ESD points, we call them ESD down here, exceptional special education. So teachers down here are not required to gain ESD in-service points. And in-service points is basically like your credits, your continuing education. And only a minimum of one semester hour in teaching students with disabilities every 6 years is required for all teachers. So it's scary. Yeah, you say, wow. I said, wow, when I did the research.
Wow.
And I know this because I actually, I was actually a participant in a class called Partners in Policymaking in Florida, and doing this research was really heartbreaking. You know, the fact that this is not even like mandated, and again, you know, the rising of the deaths that have happened in Florida make it so scary that this is even in place. So to hear what's happening with the grant and to hear what's happening in Illinois in general really puts like a big light in my head, because of the fact that Florida needs to kind of adopt the same thing, quite frankly, you know?
Yeah, I think it was definitely a shock to look at, even coming from a single school, of like our minutes and seeing the entire state's minutes now and worrying about the entire state's minutes. I mean, just with the strategies we put in place with the grants resources, we were able to decrease our minutes from what we did in a month to what we did in a year, as far as utilizing the restraint in timeout. So it was crazy to see it go from, you know, 2,000 minutes per month to 2,000 minutes per school year. And wow. We are a full year ESY type of program. So just that switch in that mentality of, okay, how can we turn off these behaviors? Like, what can we do to make sure that they're not getting to that point where they're no longer safe for themselves or others, you know, and kind of really doing some, you know, detective work and really trying to figure out what each individual student needed.
Wow, that is so amazing to me. 2,000 minutes per month to 2,000 minutes per school year. That is significant.
Significant. Yes.
You know, that is the name of the game. That is significant. Mm-hmm. And the fact that you've been able to be a huge player in this is so, so vital. You know, it sounds like what you're doing, what the grant is doing, but everyone that's involved with the grant too, I mean, you guys are making great waves over there, and I can only hope that can be the same throughout the entire country.
Yes, I hope so too, because the stories were very scary in the article of the reasoning as to why some of the students or staff kind of went into restraints and things like that, or were in timeouts. Some students were having timeouts literally from the end of the school day, and then they restarted at the next school day. There's some really heartbreaking things. And so it was a very passion project for not only myself, but the facility that I was at previously too, of, you know, what can we do about this? Because we see this as a problem. While we're not mentioned in the article at all, and we're following all of the rules and regulations, how can we decrease our minutes? Because they were significant.
That's insane that, and this, what you said about a timeout starting at the end of the day and going into the next day. I mean, neurotypical children don't process that, let alone neurodivergent children, you know, like how is that even like possible that even happened? Like, I have so many questions just about that.
I know.
Oh my gosh. Well, let's start with our first code word of the day. Our first code word is the word support. That is SUPPORT. That is the word support. So you mentioned the significance of the minutes going down from 2,000 minutes per month to 2,000 minutes per school year. That's a big success in of itself. But could you also share some examples or success stories from schools that have implemented this new approach?
Yeah. So kind of are really, I think it was also mandated that, you know, they come up with least restrictive options for students as far as trying to limit that restraint and timeout too. So one of the big things that a lot of schools found from the grant as well was the Ukiru training. So I think that was incredible to kind of incorporate and put in our toolbox too, coming from that previous setting too. Because it doesn't use any restraint, and it really focuses on how trauma can affect our brain and all of the kind of neuroscience that goes on with trauma. So it takes a deep dive into that. And I think that, like before I obtained my position with the grant, I was dealing with, you know, students that had a lot of support needs. So by partnering, we got access to all of those resources. I was trained as a Nukiru trainer. I was able to really try to think about how we could eliminate the need for restraint and timeout by using methods like that, as well as taking Greg Hanley, FTF's practical functional assessment. And that both of those are very rooted into the kind of what we disseminate to schools now as well. And I was also able to really try to adopt new coaching styles as far as we did a lot of like role playing. Okay, what are these situations that we're coming into that we're utilizing restraints over and over again? Like, what can we change about those? How can we debrief about them so that we can support that student better tomorrow? And that's really part of the rules and regulations too. They really want to know what least restrictive procedures were utilized prior to you guys going hands-on. So they have you list those in all of the documentation that you have to include in the incident of restraint or timeout. So that was really great. And I think it really helped all of our problem solving skills as a school and just as people of, you know, okay, this is keeps occurring, what needs to change? And sometimes it was, you know, maybe we need to take this item out of the environment, simple like that. Or maybe it was, do we really need to switch the staff that are in their room? We had to really think outside of the box of like, this is happening right now. It doesn't mean that we're going to remove it from that person forever, but right now we need to reduce the minutes and then slowly incorporate it back. So I think that one example of a success story would be that for one of our individuals, initially we were able to incorporate those Ukiro blocking techniques. Ukiro uses blocking pads, and we were able to completely eliminate the need of restraint and timeout for this individual, just due to a restraint-free crisis management system. And it was really great to see that from that perspective, because I really went into Ukiro training like, there's no way this is going to work. Like, what do they mean restraint free? How are we going to keep these kids that I adore safe and all of our staff safe? And really buying into it and having our staff buy into it and really realizing that there's so much more behind these interfering or maladaptive behaviors that you can really go and address by not putting your hands on them. So I think that really was a huge win of being able to eliminate restraint and timeout for at least one individual that really has some high support needs was a major win to see.
That's amazing. I mean, you know, the fact that you were able to go from having to do restraints or feeling like you have to do restraints, right, to learning this training method where you keep your hands off of this child and they didn't have any more restraints after that. I mean, that's, again, a huge significant win in of itself.
Yeah. And this was a student that needed, like, we utilized PCM as well for our restraint crisis management system. And we were utilizing the most restrictive procedure with this individual. So to go from that to not implementing a restraint system at all with them was really great to see. And just kind of the growth with that and just like, okay, how many more students can we utilize this with? What situations can we use the blocking pads instead of going hands-on? So really thinking critically in those situations.
I was going to ask you too, with regards to the Ukiro training. So what are some of the techniques that are involved in Ukiro training that may be involved for the clients that may need to have some sort of de-escalation?
Yeah. So they have a lot of like personal safety techniques that they utilize, as well as like the blocking. So they have all kinds of different pads, different sizes. They also encourage you to have the pads out for the learners or the clients to see, kind of interact with. They say you can even make it a job for them to clean them off. So they're used to seeing those in their environment, which I think is really great. I think with a lot of other systems, you're not taking equipment out until it's, you know, time to implement, where these were kind of just everywhere ready to go. The kids were very familiar with them. Some of them use them, you know, just for, you know, laying on top of, or they wanted them on their desks, things like that. And then they also utilize safety techniques where in case you are, you know, choked, Your hair is pulled, you are being bit. All of those things are also included. If your clothing is grabbed, they have all kinds of techniques for those. If not to get out of, to maintain safety until you can or have the need to go hands-on. The blocking pads, if you are using them for an extended period of time, there are some like staff things to kind of keep in mind. We did have to have like switch outs like every, you know, 10 to 15 minutes. It does get tiring kind of going back and forth with the movements that they have you do. Their movable stamps that they have. So there's a lot of different things, but I think the most important thing that as a trainer and kind of as their system is trained to us is the content, and that information is so vital. Like they don't want any of that information skipped over, but they do allow you to have the blocking pads and then the personal safety techniques as like an a la carte. So you can pick and choose which ones you want to implement or which ones kind of meet the needs of your clients, your learners that you have in whatever setting that you're in.
Wow. Now, if someone is interested in becoming a Yukuru trainer, what all do you have to do to become one?
Yeah. So the Yukuru training can be found on their website. They have a ton of upcoming trainings. It went from literally the first year that I was trained, I think they had one in the entire state of Illinois, and now they had four or five over the course of this past summer. So they are growing just like everything else, I feel like. And it's a 2-day training if you want to become a trainer. So the first day of training, you'll also be paired with like users and people that are recertifying if you have any that are in your area. And then that second day is really used to, how are you going to train this? Okay, you know this information, but like, how are you going to go back and train your staff? Which I think that is kind of, from other crisis management systems, I think that's a little bit different too. They go through page by page, like, okay, what's the significant part of this part of the training? And they tell you, okay, you really want to make this apparent when you are training it up to your staff, or this is an example that you can use, or think about your own example for this one, and kind of really hone in on trying to build your capacity as a trainer too. So that's really great. And then you do get recertified every year, and that's just a 1-day training. They will come to you if you want to host a training too, which is really great for entities that want to do that. And then there is like a yearly fee that goes along with that too.
Gotcha. That's really amazing. And I mean, the fact that this training has been able to be a big success in the reduction of timeout and restraint. Not just with the minutes, but with the injuries and most importantly, the fatalities, is definitely just a very like significant thing in of itself. So it's really amazing that you've been able to do those techniques, get yourself to become a Yukuru trainer, and also just be able to make these big waves on such a big level.
Yes. It's great. And then now our grant kind of, all of our grants still gets recertified in becoming a trainer. And we just now get to assist and kind of be that extra problem solving when it comes to utilizing Yukuru, and kind of reducing restraint for other schools too.
That is awesome. And I know one of the things that we talked a little bit about, when we first met was the APERS assessment. Mm-hmm. So first, tell us a little bit about what the APERS assessment does. And then also, too, I'd love to hear like what role it plays in evaluating and improving school programs.
Yeah. So the APERS assessment is an assessment that it really it's the first step that we use when we are partnering with a school. So that is the first thing after our contract is kind of in place. We are building our entire coaching system off this assessment. So it assesses the learning environment for that entity. It kind of looks to see if they have a positive and engaging learning climate for their students. It determines the entity's IEP development and kind of where they are in developing their IEPs and how they go about that. It also looks at the curriculum and instruction that's provided to the learners. One major thing, too, that it looks at is communication systems for the learners. Are they in place? Are they missing? All of those things. It also looks at social competence or any opportunities that learners might have to interact with peers and what that looks like. It also looks at individuals' personal independence and how staff and students kind of respond to those interfering behaviors and kind of how are they handled within that entity. It also looks at family involvement and what does that look like for that entity. What teaming strategies and, you know, as far as classroom, district-wide, school-wide, what kind of teaming supports are available for their learners? And then it also goes into how well is that post-secondary transition process? What does that look like for that learner, for that entity? And then it also, those are all kind of the areas that it looks for in that assessment. And the assessment is completed via observations, interviews, as well as reviewing records for some of the students. They go ahead and look at that stuff. And the interviews are conducted with speech and language pathologists, teachers, administrators, parents. When we can get parents to be interviewed, I feel like we get such good information from that too. And most are really flexible with allowing you, you know, that, you know, 30 minutes to an hour to be interviewed for something like this. And oftentimes that's a huge gap area for a lot of entities, is that family involvement as well as the communication systems. Oftentimes we will go into schools and the resources for communication are very limited. And I think that's another passion project for my supervisor, our director. She also has some communication background, and something I'm very passionate about too is that's what they need to tell you what they want, get their basic needs addressed, all of those things. It's so vital to all of your other programming, and oftentimes we find that as a big gap for some school entities as well.
Yeah, I mean, I can even tell you outside of a school entity, that's a pretty big gap. Period, you know, especially like when it comes to communication for families that are non-English speaking, that communication gap is absolutely a big area. And that leads to the family involvement. So yep. I feel like all of it really comes down to that communication gap. And of course, too, like with the clients as well, not having the resources for them to be able to communicate their wants and needs, that's going to play a very big role in that gap, because that can also lead to the family involvement not being as strong as well. And that's just from an outside perspective here.
Absolutely. I think, you know, getting that message of behavior is communication is really a big thing for us too, of getting people to realize that if they don't have that, you might as well not be focusing on anything else. That is really going to set them up for a lot of success. And I've had a fortunate experience with a lot of great SLPs. And I'm so glad that there has been a huge increase in the family involvement when it comes to the rollout of using like AAC devices, high-tech devices, So one of the things that our SLP used to do is making sure that the family is involved in that process as well, and having them get a little bit of training too. You know, it takes a little bit more effort to use a communication device, but they should still have that as an option to, you know, utilize. And how do they utilize it? Where are things? You know, what is the pathway to things? So I think that's super important. And it's also something that the Illinois State Board of Education focused on. And they have it in the paperwork where you do have to identify if that student had any means of communication in that incident of restraint or timeout. And I think that's the best thing that came out of all of the rules and regs, is ensuring that even if they are in a crisis state, they have to have a means of getting what they need, or telling them like, hey, I need my sweatshirt removed, I'm really sweaty right now, like something to, you know, off, things like that. So I think that is another important area for sure.
Absolutely. And, you know, you mentioned working closely with the Illinois State Board of Education. How crucial do you feel this partnership is to the success of the grant initiative?
We could not keep running and doing what we're doing without them. They are vital to the operations and funding that we are able to go into schools and provide. So we appreciate them. And my supervisor has monthly meetings where we are ensuring that we are supporting everyone and doing what we can to reduce those minutes of restraint timeout.
Wow. That is, I mean, I can only imagine the impact that it truly has, not just on, you know, the students, but for everybody, you know, you, the teachers, the paraprofessionals, even the families, even though they're not necessarily at the schools, you can only imagine the impact that the families might have as a result of that too.
Absolutely. Yep. And explaining that to parents too, because some of them don't know, you know, what's happening with restraint and timeout. Our parents at my previous placement, they had to sign off, of course, that we would utilize these if needed. But kind of introducing all of these things to them and making sure they're informed. That was another huge part of it, is parents have to be informed on their rights, and they have to be able to say, hey, if I don't like the situation of restraint and kind of what happened, because they get all a copy of all of the paperwork, they have a right to make a state complaint and have the state look further into that incident. So they can then get, you know, access to video and all of those things if your entity has that. So it's really important that that documentation is really honed in and narrowed in and really focused in on, so that if, you know, you have a state complaint in within that year, they're trying to increase it to you have more than a year to file that complaint. You have all your documentation ready to go, and you're supporting that learner as much as you can.
I'm glad that you talked about the families and them being able to know their rights, because I feel like in ABA, it's there, but it's not being as talked about. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. Yep.
I mean, like, at the very beginning of our assessment process, we do something called an initial clinical interview. We sit down with the family, we go over what ABA is, we go over what their role is, technician's role, all that good stuff. But I think one of the biggest things that kind of gets overlooked is informed consent. Yes, yep. We require a signature for you to say, hey, I agree to the plan, but how do you know exactly what you're signing up for? If, you know, if you're just being told, hey, sign this plan, you know, it really falls on the BCBA to actually give that idea. So I'm really glad that you bring that up, because parent rights is definitely an area that is completely, it's not like completely missed, but it's definitely disregarded.
Absolutely. And I think that was another thing that came about recently, was we have to include their rights with incidents of restraint and timeout. That was also provided by ISBE in every single incident that occurs. So you have 24 hours to make sure that they have a written copy of the minutes and information about that incident. And then you also have 48 hours to enter that into our student information system, which is reported to the state as well. So there's a whole lot of things on the back end too, as far as BCBAs and administration that they are doing when it comes to restraint and timeout. And while there's a lot of hoops to jump through, it's just making sure that we are doing our due diligence and supporting all of these students the best that we can with, you know, the least restrictive procedures as possible.
I completely agree. You know, I definitely see it where, like, we have had, like, documentation where it can be, like, an incident report that's sent home, essentially. But you mentioned, you know, the minutes that are accounted for. Kind of sounds similar to an incident report, but with when you're writing in the minutes, are you writing in, like, for example, you know, this person used this particular technique to decrease this? Like, how does that work from a reporting standpoint?
Yeah. So we really advise school entities to record all of their procedures, making sure that they have really great documentation when it comes to that. Like, you want to know what staff member was involved, who was on, you know, the individual's arms, legs, you know, depending on what procedure you're implementing. You also want to make sure that you are knowing how long you are in those procedures for, because there's time limits on that as well that come from the state. So making sure that all of those things are trained to your staff are incredibly important. And another thing that the grant does is what we call regional summits, and they go to different parts of the state, and it's free to sign up for, and you can come and get those situations that you're really having a hard time kind of navigating, and, you know, how can we do better here? And you can talk those out and see if you're meeting that imminent danger criteria that Illinois has. So every incident of restraint has to meet imminent danger. And there is a definition that goes along with that. So we go through what that means. We go through all of the things that are required by your school and from the state Board of Education. We will problem solve. We will help you kind of game plan your plan to decrease restraint and timeout for your district. It's really like a nice informational and like work session together, where we do even have a attorney from the Illinois State Board of Education come and answer questions during that question and answer time. So it's a really great opportunity for schools in Illinois to get the information that they need in that time period too.
Wow. That is really so invaluable to have, you know, the fact that you have attorneys that are coming in and answering questions about this. And you know, you also mentioned limitations and time limitations. I know that those can tend to be abused, and it's good to see that you have to actually like report every single minute. You know, that for me is really just so substantial because of the fact that, you know, the families do need to know, hey, what is happening? You know, what are you doing to keep my child ultimately safe?
Right. And like it's every 15 minutes it's required to see if they need any medication, they need to use the bathroom. Those basic things that some people weren't thinking about are ensured that there's an evaluation that needs to be included if that incident exceeds that 15 minute time period. So yes, it's definitely so, so important.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I am curious to know, what do you believe, whether that be your plans or, you know, plans of the state, what are the plans for expanding the grant's reach across Illinois, and how do you see this influencing the future of behavioral supports in schools?
Yeah, I think it's really great to see in a lot of schools that they are opening BCBA positions. So we have a lot of administrators that will attend and they want to either, you know, let us know that they are looking for BCBAs and we kind of will contact the people that we know or people outside of the grant to kind of fill those positions for them if we can. And then we also, we really want to make sure that we are having a coach in every kind of region of the state. So we just hired a northern coach in March. We have a southern coach position open right now. So if anyone's in southern Illinois and would love to have a position with our grant, we are hiring for that. So we have a Southern Illinois and then we have two Central Illinois coaches currently that are able to go out there and provide those program assessments and then kind of coming up with that coaching plan with that school entity and kind of what are those areas or gaps that we need to increase our scores in from those assessments. And so I think that's really going to be important to have all of our positions filled. And really, I know my supervisor really loves the communication. So we would really love to do something in that area of, you know, do we hone in on communication systems and find some SLPs to kind of work with, or what do we do with that? I know there's tons of ideas that we have. We also, this is going to be our third or fourth year of having an annual autism conference, which is held at Illinois State. So we also do that to make sure that we are getting kind of our information and what we can provide to schools out there. We have great things as far as, you know, I think it's really important. We have a parent panel and they kind of go through their lived experience as a parent of an autistic individual, as well as having a lived experience panel for autistic individuals to share their stories. I cannot mention how many tears were shed this past year of the hardships, but the celebrations that have occurred for the individuals that we had come and share those things. So I think just making our conference bigger too would be a great thing that we would love to do. Making it more days, things like that we've talked about. It's like endless opportunities, I feel like, for a grant, for sure.
Thank you for, you know, lifting up those voices. As a neurodiverse person, as somebody who, you know, has grown up in that, I feel that it's that much more important to lift up the community. We get a lot of hatred for what we do. And so the fact that neurodiverse voices are being heard on this type of platform means a lot, at least to me. And I hope it means a lot to our listeners as well.
Absolutely.
I love it. I love it. Well, our second code word, I'm going to go ahead and do that real quick. Our second code word is a place that we've been talking about pretty much all podcasts, and that is schools. That is S-C-H O-O-L-S. That is the word schools. So couple quick questions. So what would you say, like, for schools and educators who are interested in getting involved, what steps should they take to learn more or participate in this program?
Yeah, absolutely. So feel free to reach out. They can go to our website, which is autismillinois.org. They can contact us. They can locate my supervisor, Nikki Michalik's email directly on there as well. They can email her. You can attend a conference and find out more about us at an exhibit booth in Illinois. We're at tons of them in the upcoming months. and start the conversation of kind of what supports are needed, professional development within your entities. We also conduct, if you don't want a program assessment, we can come in and do a professional development, a training. So yes, please just get in contact with us. We would love to hear from you. And if we can't help you, because we are in a different state, my supervisor is a wealth of knowledge for other grants in other states that are doing similar things as well. So
that is amazing. What would you say are your long-term hopes for the impact of this grant on the educational landscape, not just in Illinois, but maybe even beyond, maybe even like eventually the country?
Yeah. I hope that, you know, there's not a lot of free options for the RBT course that this grant is working on. And so I hope that this RBT 40-hour course is a huge resource to not only the state of Illinois, but parents and educators and just people that are willing to want to know more information about autistic individuals and how they can better support and advocate and just be more, you know, mindful of the things that might be occurring. Maybe it's not something that's in your home, but it's something that your son and daughter might have within their classroom, you know, an autistic individual, and just better preparing them for how they can support them, how they can advocate for them, and how they can be just a great human being. I hope that they can take this course or take portions of the course so that they can gain more knowledge in specific areas that they want to. I think just kind of spreading the word of, you know, the neurodivergent voices and making sure that those are heard. I think that's a huge part of our project. We're already searching for people to come talk at our next conference and just making sure that we have that really as a point in a conversation, because I feel like that's also something that's very much missing. And so I hope that we continue to do that. And not a lot of autism conferences are doing that. So just hoping to move forward and keep doing great work for autistic individuals.
I love that. Thank you so much. As an autistic person, I have to thank you for what you're doing. You know, it really is so meaningful, the project that you're doing. And I do very much hope that this grant will reach beyond Illinois. I can tell you right now, being in Florida, we need something like that happening, because the Florida educational system, especially for people with disabilities down here, awful. It's awful here. So I appreciate what you're doing, and I hope you know that, like, you've lit that, like, self-advocate fire underneath me because of the fact that, you know, you're doing such great work over there, and here in Florida, it's the complete opposite. So I appreciate what you're doing, and again, from the bottom of my heart, I cannot thank you enough.
Thank you.
Of course. Well, Amanda, it has been an absolute pleasure speaking with you tonight. Tell us where we can find you or how we can contact you.
Yeah. So you can find me on Instagram. I am the remote behavior analyst on Instagram, as well as Amanda S. Lombardo. You can follow along. I share a lot of what the grant is up to. We also do monthly office hours on specific topics. So you can join the Zoom groups, and you don't have to be in Illinois. So just follow along on there. And then as well as visiting our website, again, it's autismil.org. We would love to hear from you guys.
Thank you so much, Amanda. And thank you, everyone, for tuning in to tonight's episode. My name has been Michelle Zeman. I've been your host, and I am excited to see you on the next one. Take care. Bye, everyone.